Coming up on Tech News Today, Samsung and Apple shrinking, Zynga swears off gambling, and Google has a motion-sensing Google TV up its sleeve. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, July 26th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 26 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code TNT7. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Maya Zakhtar.
And I'm Alex Gumpel, filling in for Jason Howell, who decided to take the day off.
Lazy. No, he deserved it. Actually, he's going camping. This is the show where we keep you informed on what Jason Howell's doing on his weekend and the tech news, starting with the top 10 stories of the day in the news feeds. The Wall Street Journal reports Google is working on a set-top box for your television with a motion sensor and a camera for things like Google Hangouts. A prototype was reportedly shown off in secret at the Consumer Electronics Show this past January. At the time, the device also had access to Android games and other apps from the Google Play Store. Google's Sundar Pichai told All Things D earlier this week that Google TV would soon be a full-fledged Android television.
Amazon grew its revenue by 22% year-over-year between April and June to $15.7 billion, but also posted a loss of $7 million versus a $7 million profit in the same quarter last year. So, answer, why? Amazon invested heavily in its Kindle business, digital downloads and streaming products, and is working on its China presence. And Jeff Bezos says Amazon's top best-selling products last quarter were all either Kindles or accessories for Kindles or digital content for Kindles. So perhaps it's money well spent.
IDC just released some worldwide smartphone market share numbers. Samsung and Apple are still numbers one and two, respectively, but both saw their market share drop in the quarter. Three companies are picking up smartphone users, and they are LG, Lenovo, and ZTE. LG now holds 5.1% of the market share, and that's due in part to the Nexus 4 and the Optimus G Pro. Lenovo was in the number four spot after spending two quarters out of the top five.
The Google Chromecast TV dongle just got a little less valuable. At its announcement Wednesday, Google included three free months of Netflix with the purchase of the $35 device. Now, the part of the deal is off, or at least that Netflix part is off, due to overwhelming demand. Pray Google doesn't alter the deal further.
Hacker Barnaby Jack has died in San Francisco a week before he was set to show off techniques to attack implanted heart devices that he claimed could kill someone from 30 feet away. Jack, who is a security expert, became one of the most famous hackers in the world after he showed off how to make an ATM spit out cash in a 2010 demonstration, which was then dubbed Jackspotting. Jackpotting.
Android 4.3 is out, so that means people are digging into the code to find out what's in there. Now, Android police found that the latest version of Android could support up to 640 DPI, which suggests it could run fine on a 4K display. Additionally, the site found App Ops, which would give users more control over what permissions apps have. And that feature isn't enabled yet because it isn't fully baked. And lastly, Android police found the Konami code works. Go into the game section of Google Play for a little Easter egg.
Up, up, down, down. Nice. Samsung announced quarterly earnings, and it's doing just fine. Operating profit increased 47.5% year over year. As expected, operating profit in the mobile division rose 52% year over year to 6.23 trillion Korean won, which fell 3.5% over the previous quarter, despite the launch of the Samsung Galaxy S4. Strategy Analytics estimates Samsung is now more profitable at making phones than Apple. It was a nice quarter, Samsung. You have nothing to be ashamed of.
The U.S. government is demanding internet companies give up users' stored passwords. That is according to two industry sources familiar with these orders, which points to surveillance techniques still publicly undisclosed. Now, of course, if the government has access to an encrypted password, that credential could be then used to log into an account or even impersonate the user. Obtaining it would also aid in deciphering encrypted devices in situations where passwords are reused.
Good news for Zynga. The game company reported revenues of $231 million, down 31% from a year ago, and a loss of 1 cent per share. The reported daily active users of 39 million is down 45% from last year and their worst reporting ever. How is this good news? Wall Street actually expected them to do a lot worse. New CEO Don Matrick also announced the company would no longer pursue a real money gambling license in the United States and instead focus on free-to-play social games.
I guess Wall Street was expecting them to be set on fire this year. Okay, so the BBC reports that the UK pornography filtering system is controlled by Huawei. UK-based employees from Huawei get to decide what sites and content are blocked. It's no secret that the UK and US have raised concerns about Huawei's ties to the Chinese government, and the company still maintains those concerns are unfounded.
This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by Shutterstock.com. Shutterstock.com, you can find the perfect image or video for your creative project. If you're like, well, Tom, I don't know about that. Maybe if you're working on a website, but I'm working on a publication. Yep, works for that. What about an advertisement? Yep, works for that. Video, any type of project, people, 26 million. High quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips to choose from. And you may think like, wow, with that many, they can't all be good. No, they're all high quality. They're pro photographers and artists. Shutterstock adds 10,000 new images every day to keep it fresh. And every time you visit, you'll find something new that has been approved. Shutterstock looks at all these images, even though they're adding that many a day. You can choose individual image packs or a monthly subscription for the best deal. And you can download, say, 25 images a day with the standard subscription. So that's plenty. Download any image in any size. Pay only one price. And the search tools always impress me. You can sort images by color spectrum. Many creative teams use it to get inspiration and ideas. And it's free to browse. You can start this thing called a Lightbox. If you've got a team working on something, go sign up for Shutterstock.com for free. Start putting things in a Lightbox. Share it with other people. Get ready to go on your creative project. Then you don't even need a credit card to do any of that, by the way. Then, once you're ready to purchase the images, don't forget this offer code, TNT7. New accounts receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com. For 30% off new accounts, use that offer code, TNT7. And we thank Shutterstock for their support of Tech News Today. All right, joining us as he does most Fridays, we're very happy to have Len Peralta, internet cartoonist, and my co-conspirator on the comic 10 State joining us to illustrate the stories of the day. If you're using the audio podcast, it's okay. You won't be missing anything informational, but you're going to be missing a lot of fun because Len, you do a great job with this stuff.
Yeah, it's like a secret encoded thing. You need to pour the lemonade and put like a candle underneath and see all my pictures show up.
That's how I own 3 iPods.
The only thing that's better is that you actually don't have to use any open flame to see Len's cartoons.
Exactly. Much safer.
Yeah, all you got to do is get the video version somehow, either twit.tv/TNT, or you can subscribe in lots of different places like iTunes, Downcast, Stitcher. Anyway, let's kick off the stories of the day with some of those IDC numbers that Ayaz was mentioning in the news fuse. As we mentioned, Samsung down, Apple down, LG, Lenovo, and ZTE up. Interestingly, Strategy Analytics had their numbers out. They're pretty close. They're pretty much the same as they usually are. But they show Samsung increasing market share by a couple points. They only show Apple down. And they actually have Huawei in front of ZTE at the back end of things. Samsung shipping twice as many iPhones as Apple sells now. We got a little sale versus shipped there. But that's a lot more phones. The smartphone industry grew by 50%, according to IDC, and 47% according to Strategy Analytics. Now, a lot of people say it's slowing down, but it's still growing. Lenovo and LG are growing the fastest out of this bunch. And they're selling expensive phones, too, not just the cheap one. You may say, like, oh, yeah, because everybody's selling cheap phones to the developing world. We hear all that. That's true. But they're selling a lot, and they're increasing sales of the top-end phones as well. Neil Mostyn, executive director at Strategy Analytics, says Apple doesn't just need a low-priced phone. They need that. Everybody's saying that. But they need a new flagship phone as well that will compete with the large screen phones like the phablets. This reminds me of RIM and Nokia. RIM and Nokia both were top of the world or very close to top of the world. And then as new competitors like Apple and Samsung started to gain market share, Nokia and RIM still led for a long time, but their market share began to decline. Now, am I crazy to say that Apple may be risking repeating the same mistakes?
As RIM?
RIM and Nokia.
I think if you ask anybody at Apple, they'd say, well, our growth is on the rise and we don't really care what everybody else is doing. Obviously, Apple sales are very cyclical. It has a lot to do with not just new products, but holiday seasons. If you look at a graph of charts, it's, you know, there's this sort of a spike that has become pretty constant. So, yeah, I think, as we've mentioned on the show in the past, Apple has a huge growth opportunity with a lower price device if you're talking about just smartphones. But that said, I think that this is just a market that a lot of other companies are beginning to fill into. And again, do you compare something like Huawei to a Samsung? Do you compare a Lenovo to an Apple? I think a lot of this is, well, it's all part of the same overall market, but they're very different companies who have very different offerings.
I don't think Tom's crazy with the idea of comparing them to Nokia and RIM. Those guys are the top two. They had the phone game locked up. It seemed like it was their game to lose. Motorola came in and started doing things with the Razr, and that got a lot of people's attention. And so what Apple did, they basically changed the entire game. But Apple and Samsung have done a lot of the heavy work when it comes to educating people on how to use a smartphone, because this device was pretty foreign to a lot of people, pinching and zooming, having all these advanced features. Samsung keeps upping their game when it comes to features. So it's like the market's ripe for the leaders to get knocked down, because you can have LG focusing on what they're doing with their phones, having something like the Optimus Pro, and also having their ties to Google with the Nexus to give them a nice big bolstering, because this is a flagship device for Google, not just LG. So it's if these companies aren't careful, they could lose out in the smartphone game. That's probably why we keep hearing those rumors of watches and televisions and every other little unicorn you could think of. They're still thinking phones are nice for now, but it's changing so fast, we have to figure out what else we can do.
I really do see a comparison here. And it's interesting to look at LG too, because LG was following in Nokia's footsteps almost in a worse way. They had never flown as high market share wise as Nokia, but they had built their name on feature phones, on flip phones and clamshell phones, and they had a really hard time capturing a smartphone market until the Nexus 4, and now they finally found their way at least to a rise. Certainly not, you know, dominating the market by any stretch, but they're turning things around. I don't see Samsung suffering as much as Apple. Apple seems to just I don't say that they're going to go down the same path as Nokia or RIM, but they do seem to be at that same point where they, and we've been saying this over and over and over, they need a product that captures people's attention or they're going to start getting bored. That's what happened with Nokia. Everybody loved Nokia phones, and the N95 was universally praised, but nobody bought it. It did not turn around the fortunes, and they got left behind. The difference here is that was a market at an inflection point. It was turning into smartphones. It was a whole new game. I guess my other question would be, is this the same situation? Or are smartphones mature and now we're just going to see the market continue the way desktops do with incremental changes but no revolutions?
We saw something change in the last like 5 or 6 years when it comes to phones. The idea that smartphones had to be tied to the carriers were loading crapware and bloatware, all their special features. It seems like only now are we starting to see a lot of pushback. Apple obviously did a really good job having like no branding from Singular back then when it was called Singular. I think that might make things a little different, so we could see some more rapid evolution from these different companies, so they won't just have to deal with these, oh, the carriers are going to lock us down and make sure we have really bad phones. So maybe it could actually end up more like the desktops, because there is that freedom away from the wireless carriers.
Now, a company that definitely is having a downturn, it's not imaginary or speculative, is Zynga. We heard some of those numbers in the news fuse, IS.
Yeah, I forgot that it was all good news because expectations were so low. Revenue was 38% below last quarter at $230.7 million. Excuse me. The company had a net loss of $15.8 million in the quarter. Now, last quarter had a profit of $4.1 million. Monthly average users were 40% lower than last year. Daily players fell by 45% in the quarter. So daily average users are now 39 million, the lowest since the company began keeping track. Last quarter, it fell to 52, so now they're down to 39 million. Zynga announced it's not going to pursue a license for real money gaming in the U.S., otherwise known as online gambling. Zynga says that it believes its biggest opportunity is to focus on free-to-play social games. And Don Matrick, the new CEO, says he's going to spend the next 90 days heads down with his team resetting its product release plan. Is there anything Matrick can do to really bring back engagement to the daily users that seem to be leaving in droves in a span of 3 months?
Well, this whole free-to-play thing really is where the revenue is for mobile gaming right now. I mean, you can look at, Leo and I were talking about Simpsons Tapped Out, mm-hmm. which is bringing huge amount of revenue to EA each month. And that's a great example of something that you can play it for free forever, but they end up making quite a bit of revenue on people that end up paying a little bit extra for in-game purchases. So if Zynga can execute on a freemium model that translates into a lot of people giving them money, that's great. But I think Zynga has proven that every hit that they have is just a hit for so long. So you have to completely change your strategy. I mean, you can't build some colossal company with all these employees based on games that are only popular for a month or so. And you have to be a lot more nimble. You have to be a much smaller group. You have to change your whole marketing strategy. And I think that's where Zynga has really, really failed in the past.
And yeah, you have to remember, too, that they saw this coming, right? This stuff happens in a lot slower motion than sometimes we remember. That's why they got rid of Mark Pincus. That's why Don Matrick is now the new CEO, is they saw this decline. And so you can't expect him to turn around in a quarter. We talk about this all the time when we talk about Marissa Meyer. The question is, what will he do next? And I read one of these stories. It mentioned that gaming companies actually have an easier time because all they need is another hit. It's not as hard to turn around a gaming company as it can be to turn around other kinds of software companies, especially. So if Zynga can come up with another hit, they could be back in the black very quickly. But how do you come up with a hit, right? That's the trick.
Yeah, their games have been pretty much ripoffs of other games. They've had negotiations with companies, look like they were going to buy a game, decide not to, do the exact same game. Seemed a lot of bad business practices didn't help Zynga in the old run. But with these games being like flavor of the month kind of things, does Zynga games, do they need like a movie style, like introduction? Like, here's this brand new game, it's amazing, have trailers, and then bring a lot of attention to it? Because if it's only going to be popular for like 3 months, should it be looked at like an in-theater kind of run for a movie? Because it's only for that minute that people care about it.
That's an interesting strategy.
Yeah.
Zynga also has, I mean, it bought OMG Pop for a lot of money because Draw Something at the time was a big deal. Not only did Draw Something lose its luster pretty quickly, but they basically dissolved that entire acquisition. It wasn't even like Zynga said, hey, Draw Something has a shelf life, but this team is going to give us all sorts of other hits. It doesn't even really exist anymore. And they had to write that all down. So a lot of missteps. Yeah, whether or not they saw it coming, they still spent a lot of money where they shouldn't have.
It's easy to look back and say Pincus made bad decisions by not coming up with new ideas, right? By either just trying to buy success with Draw Something or imitate success with the rap on all the Zynga games being they're just cheap knockoffs of other games. So Don Matrick's now got the pressure on him. He's decided not to go the easy route of pursuing gambling as some sort of revenue that would turn Zynga into a different kind of company, although they're still considering it in the UK, which is interesting. But they have to come up with those new ideas. And most people think the talent exists in that company to do it. We'll see if they do. Google working on a set-top box. Heard that in the news views as well, Sarah Lane. That's kind of, we all knew that they were working on one, but these details are kind of exciting.
Yeah, the sources familiar with the matter who say, hey, when Andy Rubin was still the Google executive, he showed off this set-top box at CES. It was running Android. There were Hangouts built in. You had video camera and a motion sensor. So whether or not, Google's Nexus Q didn't work out that well. Google TV still kind of trying to gain a foothold in the market. This is sort of a secret device that at least a few months ago was a real thing. And according to sources, was originally expected to launch at I.O. back in May. So if you believe all of this stuff, well, what could you do on this device that, something like the Chromecast, which obviously was released earlier this week, can't do? The idea is that this set-top box could stream YouTube videos, allow you to watch TV shows or movies from Google Play, a digital programming store. You could access Android apps, video games, potentially digital media services like a Netflix or a Pandora. If you hear all of this stuff, you say, all right, well, clearly Google wants to get into the television business in a bigger way than anything we've seen from Google TV and the Nexus Q, although it has been shelved and it's probably not coming back. That whole thing was a bit of a bust. Do we think that Chromecast is kind of the interim type of technology until the larger strategy from Google ends up being released? Maybe it just wasn't ready by I.O. Maybe this is, I don't know, we could see it later this year. Or did Chromecast replace something that maybe was a little bit loftier?
Because Ruben got like knocked out of Google meantime, it seems like that's possible. I don't know what it seems with this story and seeing Chromecast come out this around the same time as the story. Obviously, it's been held secret for, 7 months? So that's pretty impressive that this was locked up for that long. Google looks like they've partnered up with a lot of different television manufacturers. I think LG is one of the partners you can get Google TV built in. Maybe what they were showing in January was what these televisions can be next year, really. Because a lot of these televisions, LG is actually pretty advanced when it comes to the kinds of controls they've had on their televisions. They have like voice control and gesture support and all kinds of crazy things that you would normally see on a phone. If Google cracked something and explained this UI, because let's face it, LG, Samsung, these companies, they really probably don't want to do the software end of television interfaces. We've even seen Lenovo with Android TVs. So it could be something that's still coming so that it just iterates Google TV, especially with all the Google Plus integration. If you have Hangouts with your TV, maybe it makes it make more sense. I'm not sure.
Well, these reports are it's a set-top box, not a television. So
right.
This is perfectly consistent with what we talked about yesterday. Warren Raymond on Google Plus said, I'm still gainfully employed working on Google TV. Sundar Pichai said, full-fledged Android for TV, partnerships coming next CES. This all seems perfectly logical to me. That what we talked about yesterday is true. Chromecast is the gateway drug. Here it is, cheap. Learn how to use some internet TV and enjoy it. And then next year, we come with the set-top box that does all the, you know, this stuff about like potentially Netflix and Pandora. Google TV does those right now. So it wouldn't be that big of a jump for a new Google TV to do them and have all of these extra features that make it more compelling. And they've been working on an Android. It's been able to do games. So they just bust down the walls, make it a full-fledged Android device that can do all this stuff. I think that's a very logical strategy for Google.
Well, then the question becomes, so what happened at I.O.? I mean, is this just something that felt half-baked and the company thought, you know, we just need a little bit more time? Or was it more of a strategy of, let's get the public used to Chromecast and what it can do. This is a simple little solution. It's not going to cost a lot of money. It'll sell like hotcakes. We've seen that to be true, at least in the early days. People, you know, the response is very, very positive so far. And then let's give this another year of a cycle. Then we announce something that's a great product next year that the public is more ready for.
So that's why when I saw the article, I thought that maybe they showed off a set-top box and they were trying to convince partners to make more and integrate it. That way it wasn't going to be by itself an independent product right away, perhaps. And then again, we had Sundar Pichai, who was the head of Chrome, taking over Android. I.O. was a lot about Chrome, showing a lot of things about Chrome. So maybe that just became the focus because that's his baby.
Well, don't forget that Google TV was run by Salar, the head of YouTube, before they did this consolidation. So when Sundar Pichai took over, he took it over from YouTube. Those companies, you know, are not as integrated as maybe they would like you to think. My wife works for YouTube. I'm not getting any personal insight from there, but this is what I've heard from other reporters. So it may be that when Pichai took over, he said, well, wait a minute, we have this little dongle thing over here. Could we have that ready for I.O.? And they said no. And he said, well, you know what, let's make that first. He could have. I'm just speculating here. He could have come up with that strategy right there and say, let's give the set-top box more time. What you're saying, Ayaz, I think is probably true. It's not quite ready yet. Let's make sure we come out with a splash. And in the meantime, we can do the dongle to kind of keep the idea alive and resurrect interest in TV. All right. Nexus 7 went on sale today early. at a bunch of places 4 days early from what Google had said. So that's a little happy announcement there. And it looks like a lot of people are planning on buying one, huh?
Yeah, TechCrunch got some interesting numbers from Gazelle about the Nexus 7 trade-ins. Now, Gazelle tells TechCrunch there was a 333% spike in the number of Nexus 7 tablets traded in compared to the same day last week. On Wednesday, the day the Nexus 7 came out, or at least it was when it was official, it was the biggest Nexus 7 trade-in day at Gazelle ever. However, Gazelle didn't see any significant increase in iPad trade-ins on that launch day. So I'm looking at this story. I'm just kind of curious of this idea that is the Nexus 7 an Android tablet? Are they just for Android people? Is there really no pull from iOS people? And is that a real problem for Google if they can't pull over people from iPads?
Yeah, well, from what we're hearing, Apple isn't selling as many iPads. That was their latest quarterly earnings report. So it may not matter. If Google can pull people from other Android tablets into the Nexus 7, that's a growing market. So they're pulling from a growing market. Maybe that's not such a bad thing.
Yeah, I think it's more important that it's the potential market of people who don't have tablets who think, ooh, Nexus 7, that sounds great. The new Nexus 7 looks awesome. I love the idea of the smaller form factor. This is going to be my first tablet rather than iPad converts. Although iPad sales are slowing, but I think that that has a lot more to do with the fact that people are just waiting to see what's next rather than jumping ship.
Yeah, I could see that because the Mini is kind of lackluster compared to the Nexus 7 when it comes to a lot of the specs.
Now, certainly yeah, now.
That's what kind of drove me. I was a little curious about that because the Mini just does not have a screen that is as nice as the one that's on the 7. And so the price seems really low. So I'm just kind of curious why people aren't jumping ship right now, other than the fact they probably are waiting until September to see what Apple does, and then we'll see if trade-ins happen or not. But I can see
if you're a Nexus 7 user right now and you buy the new Nexus 7 and you turn it on, what happens? You get all of your settings and programs because you log in with your Google ID. If you're an iPad user right now and you buy a new Nexus 7, what happens? You have to rebuild from scratch. So there's a bigger barrier to make that jump to be considered as well.
That's a good point. That whole app ecosystem lock-in, or if you bought apps, you have your in-game progress, all that kind of stuff you don't want to lose. I don't know. I have an iPad and I have a Nexus 7. And I did actually trade it in that day, like $60-something, so I can get the new Nexus 7. And I'm a little miffed that Best Buy apparently has it in store now. So I'm waiting till whenever it ships, like Monday or Tuesday.
I think it also has a lot to do with, and not everybody has a bunch of different Apple products, but I do. You know, I've got an iPhone, I've got my MacBook, I've got my iPad, I have two iPads, you know, for one for testing purposes for Twit. But it's all part of the same Apple ID. And so I've got all sorts of iCloud syncs and PhotoStream, and it all works not seamlessly, but pretty well. And as soon as I go over to, let's say, a Nexus 7, which, by the way, I think looks awesome. I'd love one of those. All of a sudden, that's like my other weird device that doesn't actually talk to my other devices as well as if I stayed within the Apple ecosystem. I know Apple wants me to feel that way. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that that's the answer, but yes, I think that it does contribute to overall inertia.
I haven't had that kind of experience. I have a couple Android devices and a couple of Apple devices, and I just kind of, because of all the third-party services I use, or maybe because I'm so into the Google universe, I'm not really logging in with my Apple ID to check messages. That's like the one thing that's still locked to Apple, where I'm like running to my iPad for that messages app. But I, because of all the web services I use, it seems like they're almost interchangeable at this point. They're like the big thing that keeps me in my Nexus 7 or my S3 is like the keyboard. I just can't switch keyboards on an iPad. So I guess it's an interesting idea that at least I can switch easily, and then some people can't.
And I swear this is the last of our big Google stories, but Google filed with the Securities Exchange Commission announcing how much it actually paid for the map app Waze company. How much they pay for Waze? How many Instagrams?
966 million Instagram. No, $966 million for Waze. So that's just under the rumored $1 billion. This was filed, so this is public knowledge now. It's something that Google had to do. Breaking down the numbers, $847 million in what they call goodwill, $188 million in intangible assets, and then minus $69 million in net liabilities. That turns into just under $1 billion for Waze. Now, of course, this was a fairly recent sale, about 6 weeks ago. So far, no huge integrations. A lot of speculation with how Google Maps is going to change, integrated into Waze, or possibly do they stay two standalone products forever with more Google Maps technology integrated into Waze? Could go either way, maybe both. But this turns into a pretty big acquisition first half of 2013 for Google. Google bought Makani Power, Behavio, Wavy. We've talked about some of this stuff on past episodes. For these other acquisitions, $344 million along with the Waze acquisition. So if you tally them all up in 6 months or so, it's about $1.31 billion that Google spent on technology and talent from other companies. I guess I figure, all right, well, $1 billion for Waze, $1 billion, I don't know. It doesn't raise as many eyebrows as it used to, but it's still a very large chunk of change for a company.
It doesn't go as far as it used to, does it?
No, or it certainly doesn't have the same impact. But we're looking at almost $1 billion when you break it down for this company. I don't know. Do we think the price is right? And if so, how long until we see Waze integrated in Google Maps so that everybody feels like this was a solid, solid investment?
I'm really curious what Google ends up doing with this. I love Waze, and I use Google Maps both. And I go back and forth. I go to Google Maps because it's easier to find a place. When I'm like, I know the address, or I don't know the address, actually. I know the name of it. I put it in Google Maps. It finds it. I press, you know, directions, and I go there. But if I'm worried about time or I'm worried about traffic, I always go to Waze because they're much better at routing me around traffic, and they adapt on the fly to the changing conditions. So when those two finally merge somehow, will be a great day personally for my driving habits. But I think it would be a mistake for Google to lose the Waze identity somehow. So I don't know what they should do.
Well, actually, because of their valuation of goodwill, that's like an intangible asset that you can do in accounting. I took some accounting classes in school. And so they obviously have they put a large value on the Waze name, $847 million of a $966 million purchase. That means that the majority of Waze has nothing to do with their people, their assets, or anything. It's just their actual name and how well it actually resonates with everybody who uses it. So I don't think they would be crazy enough to remove the Waze branding. It might just be as simple as the way they've integrated Zagat on their knowledge graph. You'll still see it. It's Google-powered. Might say a Google company underneath or something like
that. Wait, I'm confused. You just said that all they paid for was the name, but then you said it wouldn't be a big deal to lose the branding?
No, okay. I said they would keep the branding. So we did a Google search for something, like a location. It might say, you know, the Waze data would be there, and you say maybe a little underneath, like Motorola has, you know, Google company. That would be the small part. But the amount of money they've actually put on their accounting for Goodwill, it screams, there's no way they're getting rid of that brand.
Yeah, I think for something like Zagat, and it's sort of a weird comparison, obviously, because Waze is they're very different companies, but Zagat was something that was like this. Oh, remember the Zagat books? Mm-hmm. We used to all have those on our bookshelves. Some of us did anyway. But it seemed a little bit like it was a good time for Google to snatch up that company and integrate what's actually very good information, but seemed a little bit, you know, old time, you know, the book era before Web 1.0 happened. So it was like, oh, that's a good acquisition. You can make something with this. Waze is so new and is still something that people are getting used to, the idea of socially sharing maps data and helping people plan their routes. That, yeah, I don't think Google wants to screw with that too much because it's still a service that is growing in popularity and still sort of proving itself as something that people want to be involved with in a community sense.
And it's a bit of a social network. I mean, it is a social network,
absolutely.
And people identify. Like, I see people with their modified icons when I'm driving. You know, some people are really get into it and they feel a part of that community. And so another reason why you're right, Sarah, is that would be a bad idea for them to get rid of that.
Yeah.
They just anger a bunch of people. All right, let's conclude our discussion segment with the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Intellectual Property reviewing copyright policy. They kicked off the first of two sessions yesterday. They're going to talk to content creators this week. That's what they did yesterday. And they're going to talk to the technology representatives next week. So who did they get to represent us? The content creators, right? They, by the way, not representing us, the content consumers. All right. You apparently your voice is not important to Congress. But they got Sandra Esters, head of the Copyright Alliance, a supporter of SOPA, by the way. Eugene Mopsik of the American Society of Media Photographers, a supporter of SOPA, by the way. John Lapham of Getty Images, a stock photo agency notorious for fiercely protecting their copyright. Tor Hansen of the American Association of Independent Music, a supporter of SOPA, and William Sherrick of Stereo D, which does 3D imaging for major studios. Those are the five people representing where the future of copyright should go. And here's what William Sherrick had to say. If an environment exists that does not provide adequate copyright protection and blockbuster films become unaffordable and unprofitable due to the threat of piracy, this new and thriving 3D industry will be significantly hampered.
Thriving 3D industry, huh?
Also, they repeatedly,
how it thrives.
Many of the witnesses said, we've got to watch out for fair use creep and fair use expansion. This is, to me, absolutely exemplary of the problem with the copyright discussion. And what I was hoping Congress would do by reviewing copyright is start with an evidence-based approach, saying, let's find out what effect copyright is having, positive or negative, on innovation and creativity. They actually say that. In the subcommittee launch of this, they say we need to look at what effect this is having on what the framers intended. So they say they're doing the right thing, but instead they get a bunch of people from the industry who say, you know, we're probably going to become unprofitable and unaffordable, even though there's no evidence of that. Absolutely zero evidence, and they didn't provide any evidence. And then they said that 3D would be threatened by this, as if 3D wasn't threatened by its own incomprehensible lack of appeal to consumers. And then fair use creep? Excuse me? The fact that we almost have zero fair use, it means that it's creeping up and it's threatening? This got me going. What did you guys think?
Yeah, the 3D industry argument, couldn't they come up with something? I don't know. I mean, if you're thinking of the blockbuster film industry. Yeah, I mean, I guess you can point to something like 3D is very obvious within the last 5 years. There's a lot more of this than there used to be, and some people enjoy it. I'm not saying that 3D is complete BS and that nobody cares, but it is a weird example to say, because of piracy, the threat of piracy, the 3D industry that is beloved by all, far and wide, is threatened because people just aren't picketing on corners about this sort of thing.
And let's just assume that the 3D industry was thriving. All right, let's say that. Okay. How is in having tighter copyrights going to stop that? The technology itself is so difficult to replicate already. It's very, very hard to, like, we're going to take a single camera at a 3D movie and you're just have that go, or you're going to have one camera through a lens of a polarized lens. I just don't see how they're connected, really.
Well, I think the implication is like, if you wanted to go to a 3D movie, it would have to be twice as much money because
really
of all
is.
The piracy and the fact that the studios can't reap the rewards anymore.
It's already magically cost more.
He said unaffordable and unprofitable. So he implied that, like, if we don't strengthen the already ridiculously strong copyright laws, we won't be able to afford to make 3D movies anymore.
This is like that argument. There'll be no innovation if patents disappeared. It's like stuff will keep happening, even if copyright disappeared or was, I don't know, not like what, 70 years plus the lifetime of, I don't know what, this, like the sun, it seems like at this point. it's ridiculous. It's the arguments these guys have to make, right? I think we all agree that since they're in the business, they're going to say, what's going to make us the most money? We're going to scream about this. I'm pretty sure their bosses are telling them to say this.
This is not the argument they have to make. This goes well beyond the argument they have to make. I know what you're saying, Ayaz, which is obviously these guys are going to push for things that help their industry out. But this doesn't even help their industry out. All this does is make things complicated for consumers and make things harder. And I would argue, actually, in the long run, will work against their own industry because there's a lot of actual evidence, like actual studies and evidence, that show that the lack of the ability to use fair use, the fear of being prosecuted even if you are executing fair use, and the incredibly long copyright protection term is reducing creativity and innovation and taking money out of the economy. I would like to see that evidence at least considered instead of this, which has zero relevancy and zero actual accuracy. This is just an empty phrase. There's nothing in this. This is not helping at all. Fair use creep? I think we know who the creep is.
Ooh.
Well said.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Shall we go to the randomizer?
Yes.
We had a randomizer vote again in the chat room today. I really liked make your own protein snacks at home with this tabletop insect farm. where you farm flies and you keep breeding flies, and then you take some of their larvae and turn it into a protein snack that tastes like potatoes. But apparently that was disgusting. So instead, fake memory implanted in mice with a beam of light, which I have to admit is pretty freaking cool, is the one that won. This is in the Hindu.com, and they're talking about, it's actually written by Jonathan Webb at the University of Oxford. In the journal Science, researchers have said they were able to create a false memory in a mouse. What they did is they were able to target the neurons that a mouse had used to associate a geographical location that he was neutral about. They used a beam of light. What is this called? It's called spectral optogenetics, to control those circuits, to control those neurons and turn them into a negative experience. And the mouse avoided that area as if he, as something bad had happened there.
I saw the headline and I'm a Wolverine fan. So I'm like, fake memories, implants, memory implants. This is brilliant because that's what they did to Wolverine. I don't know if anyone was excited about the movie or the comic book, but that's.
Len called it Mouseception.
Mouseception? Okay.
But I'm Mouseception or a little bit of like Eternal Sunshine. I mean, I don't think anybody would like a bad memory implanted into our mind of something that didn't exist. But I don't know. Think about the implications of somebody who has memory loss in general, you know, like an Alzheimer's patient. You could, if it was instead of a negative memory, a positive memory, something that could kind of reconstruct the past, even if it wasn't necessarily accurate, to make somebody feel better overall.
So like light, so like drugs for your brain. Be like, okay, you had a really happy childhood. Here you go. Here's your flashlight.
Well, yeah, because sometimes, you know, if you going senile and having memory loss can be a source of consternation and upset. Yeah, upset feelings. So it's kind of neat. Well, kind of scary, but kind of neat.
Pretty interesting stuff from Susuma Tanigawa of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and his colleagues. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Let's see what's on the calendar.
Okay. LibreOffice 4.1 has been released. A lot of improvements, a new improved sidebar based on Apache OpenOffice, some more embedded fonts, better Microsoft Office compatibility. Go ahead and grab that if you haven't already. The 16th annual Black Hat starts tomorrow in Las Vegas. It'll be at Caesars Palace, runs through the 1st. Google Plus Local for iOS, not going to be around much longer, is going to be laid to rest forever on August 7th. So, you know, don't get too involved right now. And Xiaomi is holding a press conference on July 30th to announce a product-related partnership with Tencent's messaging service, QQ.
And if you don't know who any of those companies are, remember them or look into them, because those are all companies that are on the rise.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's see what's incoming. What could it be?
Incoming message.
I think what's a message from Lucas. Okay, says hi there. On episode 801, you guys talked about Professor Becker's idea of getting rid of software patents. Well, I live in Brazil, and where we don't have software patents, and code is protected under authorship law. So I thought I could offer some insight on how things work over here. First of all, I don't think innovation suffers that much, although that's hard to tell. Software development over here doesn't seem less innovative, than other sectors of the economy.
British, I guess.
Thank you. On the contrary. But there is another interesting thing to note. The fact is that there is no software patent doesn't completely prevent patent law to be used. For example, mathematical formulas and algorithms are still protected under patent law. So what high-level developers will do is use trade secrets to protect specific methods and simpler code ideas, but they use patent law to protect the real brains of their applications as a mathematical algorithm. I think this is, in fact, an elegant solution to the problem. Even though it is certainly less protective to developers, it is less suited for trolls. Anyway, love the show.
Yeah, I agree, Lucas. That's pretty elegant. Nice job, Brazil. Well done. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of our show, which means for the benefit of the video viewers, it's time to check in with Len Peralta. He'll describe it for the audio viewers, but it's not the same. Len, show us what you've been illustrating throughout the show.
Oh, I will. I want to say the stories were a lot of fun, and I think these are some of the best things I've drawn for the show so far. So yeah, the first story is Apple and Samsung taking a hit from companies like Lenovo. I don't know. I just thought of Lenovo growing, and I'm on a Pacific Rim sort of thing. So here's okay. The Kaiju Lenovo who is going to destroy Apple and Samsung. So
they need to build some robots.
That's the next thing. That's what Apple and Samsung are going to be doing next. They're going to be doing some Jaegers to take down Lenovo. So that's story one. Zynga You know, I still play some Zynga games every once in a while, but the new game here, it sounds like it's Leaving Zynga with Friends is a new game from Zynga.
Me and all my friends are leaving Zynga now.
Yeah, Leaving Zynga with Friends. The story about the Google set-top box, ooh, sort of, you know, once again, kind of coming back to this scary Google thing reaching out from you from the from your television set. I have an issue with Google, I think. But there's that image. The Eye of Sauron, if you notice, is in the middle of the screen there. Chrome. The Nexus 7 owner, the typical Nexus 7 owner, this is not really true, eating a banana, throwing away their Nexus.
Why
their
is he
old
eating
Nexus.
A banana?
I don't know. I just thought it would be funny to have him throwing away his old tablet on a pile of other tablets.
Ayaz, what do you think of Len's depiction of a typical Nexus 7?
Well, I'll tell him that I don't have a banana in my hand. I do have a water bottle and a Nexus that I will chuck into the pile, but I don't know.
Well, this is being a digital sketch, I can actually change that to a water bottle.
Yeah, make a water bottle and get the guy a mustache, would you? Seriously. But otherwise, completely accurate.
The story about the Waze bill, you were saying that, you know, $1 billion doesn't really, nobody blinks an eye at $1 billion. I'd be hard pressed to find anybody who'd be able to spend $1 billion on anything nowadays. So this is my take on Google, kind of like a bender later saying that settles it. No more buying companies after a Jolt Cola binge drinking session. The Waze bill comes due and it's a lot of money, I think, personally. But then again, I'm not
Google, suggesting
so.
They drunk bought Waze.
Yes. Yes, I think that's what happened. They were just a long night, and there might not that there's any reluctance there, but you know, it's one of those things. And then finally, Tom, the fair use creep, I think it needs to be personified. Come meet Boris, the fair use creep, 1 to 2 p.m. at the Twit Studios. He'll be here all week. So Boris, the fair use creep, ladies and gentlemen,
he'll be here forever. Sadly. Nice. Nicely done. Led Peralta.
Good stuff.
Print, yes.
And people always ask us, like, I want to see all the stuff he drew on the show. Where can I see all the stuff he drew? You can not only see it, but you can buy some of them too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You can go. The best way to do it is to go to Twitter. Follow me at Len Peralta. There'll be all kinds of. There's a direct link to my store in my Twitter profile. And real quick plug: go to Kickstarter, search Jawbone Radio, and back our Kickstarter. That's all I'll say about that.
One of the OG podcasts and one of my favorite podcasts ever, Jawbone Radio, is what I will say.
Two more weeks, ladies and gentlemen. We only have 2 more weeks to do it, so please, please make it out there.
All right, don't forget about our subreddit, technewstoday.reddit.com, where you can vote on the stories of the day. Vote them up, vote them down. Vote them, can't roll them sideways. You can only vote them up or down, but you can submit your own. Also, if you liked a particular moment at any of our shows anywhere on Twit, let us know for our best of shows at the end of the year at twit.tv/best of. You can find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. You can email us, tnt@twit.tv, or give us a call and leave us a voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. We'll be back on Monday with Kevin Toefel as our guest. See you then. How we do it.